Yes, my name's Clarence Harrison.
You always look for the hero to come and clear things up. So I'm looking around knowing somebody's going to come and straighten this up. And that's when I seen my mama sitting over there crying. That's when I realized that these folks had found me guilty of something I ain't did.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who have been convicted and exonerated for crimes they did not commit. It also helps to educate all involved on the breakdowns in the criminal justice system. Listen, learn, and advocate for those who need it most. Thanks for joining me for episode 16 of Actual Innocence. I feel like I learn more about the faults in the justice system with each story of injustice, and this case is no exception. People have asked about my ad placement and why I can't just put them all together at the beginning so they can be easily skipped. The thing is that these sponsors are so important to the sustainability and continuation of this podcast that I would ask that you don't just skip them. I would go even further and ask that you support them. Both of the sponsors in today's show, Stamps.com and The Great Courses Plus, offers an absolutely free trial, and I implore you to try them. I only use sponsors that I can endorse with a good conscience, and both of these are winners. Supporting my sponsors tells them that Actual Innocence is a show worth supporting. That being said, let's talk about Stamps.com. Have you ever found yourself saying, "Why do we do things like this?" and answering it with, "Because that's the way we've always done it." A lot of small businesses find themselves getting stuck doing things the old way, just out of habit, including making trips to the post office that can be so time-consuming and make your workload feel so much bigger. If that sounds like you or your small business, and you're still spending your valuable time making trips to the post office, you need Stamps.com. Being able to do my mailing and shipping right from my desk has changed my life, and it will change yours too, by never having to go to the post office again. You can print postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer, and simply hand it to your mail carrier or drop it in a mailbox. Plus, it will save you money. Using Stamps.com, you'll get special postage discounts you can't even get at the post office. I use Stamps.com to mail out the thank you cards to my Patreon users, and more recently, I've used it to send care packages to some of my favorite podcasters. You might have heard of them. You know, Susan, Rabia, Colin. If you sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code ACTUAL, you'll get a 4-week free trial, including postage and a digital scale. Have I mentioned how cute that little scale is? You'll also be showing Stamps.com that you support this podcast. Did I mention it's free? So, please, don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ACTUAL. That's Stamps.com. Enter ACTUAL. 3 faulty DNA testimony and a lack of defense, Clarence Harrison spent nearly 17 years in prison for a robbery, kidnapping, and rape he did not commit. I'm sometimes afraid I will become desensitized after hearing story after story of the system failing innocent people, but each time it so deeply affects me, and this story is no different. Clarence is from Georgia, and sometimes he speaks so passionately and so quickly about what he's saying, it's a little hard to understand for those of us not from Georgia. I'm not going to let dialect prevent someone's story from being told, so I will do my best to make sure his message comes through clearly. I'm Brooke, and this is Clarence's story.
Prior to my arrest, I was married, and I had 2 kids. And I was working, and at the time I used to, I like to play poker. I play poker over to a neighbor's house every weekend, and that's where I were on the day of the crime. I'm more like a family man, but then I was still 27, kind of young, immature too.
I asked Clarence what he could tell me about the crime that he was accused of.
On the morning that the crime was supposed to occur, I had been playing cards at my neighbor house across the street from my home. When I finished playing cards, I seen a dude go up the street, walking up the street, and asked where he was headed. He said, to the bus stop. And I said, well, you better hurry up, like it's finna pour down rain. He told me, well, I'm gonna walk. You know, I said, well, you don't have to run because it's finna pour down rain. And I walked on in my house.
Early on the morning of October 25th, a young woman was attacked as she was walking to the bus stop in Decatur, Georgia. She was hit in the face and then dragged to an embankment, which is basically a man-made ditch, and raped. She was then dragged to two other locations and raped again each time. The attackers stole her watch and money and left her with two broken front teeth. After the attacker left, she went to a friend's home and called the police. They took her to the hospital where she received treatment and a rape kit.
Well, the next morning when I woke up, my mother had asked me to go to the store. At the time, I walked to the store for her. And on my way back from the store, I seen a car. I noticed it, that it looked like a police car, but I didn't see anyone inside. And as I was walking past the car and was going through the apartment complex, the car came behind me and stopped beside me and asked me, what's my name, Clarence? I told him, yeah. He said, you live in the house? I said, yes. And he said, asked me, did I see anyone go up the street? I said, I seen a guy go up the street when I was leaving the car gang in my neighbor's. He asked me, did I know him? I said, no, I didn't live over in the area because I knew everyone over in the area. He said, asked me what the guy looked like. I said, well, what he supposed to have done, you know? And he told me he supposed to rob the lady at a bus stop. And I asked him what the victim's name was because I knew everyone in the neighborhood. He said, last name was Duncan. I said, Duncan, you must be talking about Ken and Harold Duncan, them sisters. I said, because them the only Duncan that live in the area. He said he didn't know the relative's name. He said, all he knew was the victim. Then he said, well, what did the guy look like? I said, well, if I see the guy again, I tell Ken and Harold, and I let them tell you if they want to. Deal like that. He said, so you want to tell him? I said, man, I don't want to have no dealing with no police. And after I told him, so you're not going to tell him? I said, I'll tell them. And he said, well, I'll see you again. Then a day or two later, he came back to my house.
Clarence was playing cards at a friend's house. And as he left, he had a short exchange with a man who was on his way to the bus station. The next day, his mother asked him if he would walk to the store for her. While performing this task, he was questioned by an officer and told the name of the victim of what the officer said was a robbery. Clarence said that he did not know the man, but if he saw him again, he would tell him that the police wanted to speak with him. Clarence did not feel comfortable talking to the police directly.
That's why you keep coming to my house. You come to my house, you know, they're like, I told you, man, I tell them. He said, you're not going to tell me. I said, I tell them. They can tell you if they want that. And so he said, well, okay, then I see. So next time I know, he called me back, come back to my house the day after and told him I need to go to the police station with him. I said, for what? He said, he wanted to ask me some questions. I said, well, I ain't got no problem with that, you know. So he took me down to the police station, asked me questions about all kinds of robbery. I said, man, I don't know nothing about no robbery. Then he said, well, let me see your hand. He started looking at my hand and took a pin or poking in my hand. He said, hold up, man, what you trying to do? Why you keep sticking me like that? He said, you supposed to have a cut. I said, I supposed to have a cut. If I had a cut on me, I'd have a cut on me.
This part is a little hard to understand, but Clarence is explaining that after he went willingly with the officer to the police station, the officer started examining his hands for cuts.
He said, well, get up there and take a picture. I said, well, that's up to you, man. I said, well, I'm on arrest now. So he took my picture stuff. He said, no. He said, no, you're not on arrest. Well, you can go and take me back home because you're acting crazy, man. You know. So he took me back home. And the next day, he came to my house with a arrest warrant for armed robbery, kidnapping, and rape.
The police took Clarence's picture while he was at the station in order to put it in a photo array that would be shown to the victim.
They said, did he have a warrant for me? He said he had a warrant for my arrest.
when he took me down there and when they arrested me, like, you know, I kept saying, how you going to charge me with that junk like that? Man, them some serious charges. He said, well, she took your pictures like that. And she said, pick my picture. I said, pick my picture for what? I said, what my picture doing in a photo with outrageous like that? He said, because I put them down. So I said, man, you need to go talk to her, man, because they laid down and picked the wrong person. We were all going back and forth about that. I said, man, look, you got the wrong person, man. I don't know why you trying to put this on me like that, you know. He told me, well, you still not going to tell me where that guy was? I said, I don't know the dude, man. I told you I'd tell her, brother. And I said, nah, I ain't telling you nothing now.
Clarence was understandably upset about being charged with a crime he did not commit. It bothers me that the police at this point were still leaning on Clarence to share the name of the man that he had spoken with on the way to the bus stop. It kind of feels to me like an acknowledgement that they knew they could have the wrong person. It doesn't bother me, though, quite as much as how Clarence's attorney was appointed.
Next thing you know, I went before a frame here. Well, see, I had I got in a car accident, and my back had hurt because I had hurt injured my back from my jaw, from a car injury. And I had won a settlement, and they had an attorney named Kenneth Secret told me he'll represent me for the settlement that was awarded to me. I never did see the settlement, never did know what I was awarded. All I wanted him to do was represent me because my freedom meant more to me. And he told me he would represent me. But when I went to the administrator here, he wasn't there. And Joe asked me where he was. Well, I gave my settlement for my award from a car accident. He's supposed to be here to represent me. So Joe said, you don't have time to know. So a lawyer walked by the hallway, and he called the lawyer in and told me he wanted to represent me. The lawyer told him, said, well, I can't represent you, Your Honor. You have to be assigned to me from upstairs. And Joe said, I'm assigned to you. He said, well, Your Honor, I got a full caseload. And I'm not able to represent this client because I have already a full caseload. He said, well, I'm signing to you now. And they were arguing back and forth. And finally, the lawyer ended up representing stuff.
Okay, so wait a minute. Clarence had won a settlement in a case involving injuries that he had sustained in a car accident. In exchange for keeping that settlement money, the attorney agreed to represent him in this case. However, on the day of the arraignment, he was nowhere to be found. So, the judge pulled in a public defender that just happened to be walking by the courtroom. The public defender stated he could not adequately represent Mr. Harrison because he already had an extremely full caseload. That, and the fact that he didn't know anything about Clarence's case, didn't seem important to the arraignment judge, and this man became Clarence's representative.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I said, wait a minute. I said, y'all seen I'm supposed to be locked up for rape and all that kind of stuff. I said, don't y'all supposed to have some kind of testing and stuff y'all supposed to do in cases like that? I said, can't y'all do some tests like that? He said, so you requesting blood test stuff? I said, I'm requesting whatever is necessary to prove my answer. I said, I ain't committed the crime. I said, whatever kind of test y'all do, you know, in all these kind of cases, you need to do it just because I have not done anything, you know. So he said, I'm requesting that you get blood samples and stuff. So that's how I got the blood tests and stuff.
Clarence then points out that he believes there is some type of scientific test that should be able to prove his innocence. Clarence does this, not his attorney. And so, some blood tests are ordered. I was curious about the timeline between the day of his arrest and the date of trial.
Well, I was arrested on, November 4th. And the trial was March the 16th through 17th. Yeah, 2 days trial. But when I was in county jail, that detective kept coming to visit me and say, visited me about three times, I think. And then they called some guy over from the district attorney office and asked me would I consider a plea bargain of 3 years. I told him, I said, man, I wouldn't plea bargain for nothing. If you want to give me time, sir, I said, man, I ain't going to plead something I ain't did. I just think I want to walk around and be cued some smiths like that. He told me, so you don't want to make a plea bar? I said, no, I ain't finna make no plea bar. He said, well, your attorney, you know, just wanted me to talk to ask you anyway, you know, like that. I said, I'm not doing no plea bar. I ain't done this, and I ain't finna plead guilty to it either.
I wondered what the results of that blood test stuff was. And this is the way Clarence explained it.
He said, well, the blood sample is saying that 88% of the population could have been perpetrated and only 12% of the population could have been eliminated. But it tried to, the experts testified saying 22% of the population could be a possible suspect and only 88% was eliminated, which was an inaccurate number. I thought that was, you know, crazy. I thought, man, how she gonna say, she ain't gonna pick me and say I'm the one out of 80% of the whole world like that, you know?
I'm not a scientist, but this is my best understanding of the DNA evidence that was used at trial. 80% of the population falls into a category known as secretors. That means their blood type is detectable in their bodily fluids, such as saliva, semen, and vaginal secretions. Both the victim and the perpetrator of this crime fell into that 80% of the population. And through testing, they were able to identify that both type A and type O blood were present in the swabs from the victim. After making that identification, people who were type B and type AB secretors would be eliminated as having perpetrated the crime. Clarence had type A blood, so he, along with 80% of the population, could have been a potential match. When reading through the court transcripts, the way this information was presented felt as if it was almost stated backwards. If I were on the jury, it would have been very difficult for me to understand the implication of this evidence. I asked Clarence how his attorney helped to explain this evidence and what his other defense strategies were.
That man defense wasn't in. I don't know what his defense was, but I know I had told him, you know, I wanted to prove, man, I kept telling him, I said, well, there go Naomi and Betty and all the people who did the card game where I was playing cards at. I said, you need to call them and see, and they'll tell you where I was playing cards about not what time I left. He said he didn't have a defense to prove my illness. His defense was to allow the state the opportunity to prove me guilty.
Sadly, this is not even close to the first time I've heard of the no defense defense. I wanted to clarify that none of his alibi witnesses had been called.
No, he didn't call them. He wouldn't even call my mother. And my mother, the one who opened the door and let me in and stuff, and the one who woke me up that morning. He wouldn't even call her. He talking about the jury would believe that any mother would lie for their child. So her testimony wouldn't be valid. Which bothered my mother, because when she visited me in the prison, she kept on feeling like she was responsible because she didn't tell them I was at home and what time she let me in and stuff. I said, Lord, he wouldn't let you go out there. You know, not if you don't told, don't feel bad. It wasn't your fault.
Imagine knowing that your child is innocent, but you couldn't help him. Would you feel the same guilt as Clarence's mother? I asked Clarence how long the jury deliberated, and he told me 2 or 3 hours. It took me that long just to try and understand the scientific testing in this case.
Yeah, they found me guilty. I'm sitting there looking, and I said, wait a minute, no, they can't find me guilty. I know they heard the same thing I did. And then they're now talking about me. I said, I know where they're going to find me guilty or something I ain't doing, you know. I said, no, it must be a mistake, you know. You know, you always look for the hero to come and clear things up. So I'm looking around knowing somebody's going to come and straighten this up. And then when I seen my mama sitting over there crying, that's when I realized that these folks, they found me guilty of something I ain't did. So he sent me to life plus 20 plus 20.
Clarence's hero wouldn't come until much later. I asked if he could tell me about his prison life.
When I went to prison, I was so, it was like reliving that crime over and over in my head. You know, I kept reliving and trying to figure out what happened, how I get involved in it, how they going to say I done something, how they put me to the crime. And I kept on, you know, and then I started drawing diagrams of it, trying to figure out how this crime happened and how, you know, they could say it, I'd done this and all. You know, and it was, I was more or less so strung out on the case and thing. I was like living in two different worlds. I was in the zone, like, for the first couple of years. I was kind of, like, lost. My wife, she divorced me, and I didn't get a chance. I seen kids probably once or twice when my mother brought them down. And after she passed, I ain't seen them no more. it was a good drive. I was in Dodge County. That's the one when she came to visit me when I was in Dodge. That's the last time I saw her. While I was in prison, I started writing, trying to write all kind of people seeking help. And I didn't actually know who to write or how to try to seek help. So I just started writing people. I was trying to write the songs to them. Whoever, you know, I thought that might help me turn to ask them. Just, I kept writing it to her over and over, asking to reinvestigate the case, asking how I got involved, how was I implicated, how was I put to the cream, you know, and I was asking them just investigate the case, you know. And they were saying that, and the district attorney wrote back and told me it wasn't a guilty duty. The jury found me guilty, you know. So that the judge couldn't reinvestigate the case. So the people from a seeking judge, central ministry, some intern from central ministry wrote me and said they was at my trial. And they wanted to know if I would allow them to use my case, you know, for a class or a project. And I told them that they would. And they told me they thought I was a classic case of wrongful conviction.
After being contacted by Century Ministries, Clarence was told that his case sounded like a classic case of wrongful conviction. I asked him how that affirmation felt to him.
Red Dell was kind of like giving hope because they're the first person to really just believe in. And I kind of, and that was, that kind of lifted when I heard them say, these folks would sit there and they thought that, and then I started thinking about wondering how did I get it. And then I'm seeing the identification, classic case, mistaken identification and all that, you know. I said, how do you correct mistaken identification? And I was trying to figure out all that. Well, they later wrote me and told me it was a new test that he was doing on Dawes thing that they'll be doing in U.S. that can tell by the genetic genes what person from each family member is who, you know, give the identity. And they were talking about DNA, and they told me, so I need to write my attorney, and that's my attorney, to request to have all the evidence in my case preserved for future DNA testing. So I wrote my lawyer and told him I wanted to have all the physical evidence and whatever tests that were on preserved for future testing sometime in the near future. But the lawyer ended up, when he wrote it, the district attorney agreed to allow the test to be done. But he said then when they done the test, they said the test was unsuitable because of some dye. DNA testing because of some type of dye which was inaccurate. That was, I found out later since I've been out that was inaccurate that they could have done it back then, you know. But then the lady said, well, what about the clothes that was that the victim was supposed to have, the blood and stuff that was gone? The request to have the whole thing preserved. So I wrote my lawyer and told him to have all the physical clothing and stuff preserved for future DNA testing. And the lawyer wrote me back and told me all the evidence in my case had been removed and destroyed. There was no other evidence in existence. And I wrote and told the intern from seeking central ministry what the attorney had told me. And they told me that that sometimes happened because of storage space and things. A lot of state officers use that excuse for storage space.
It was like a roller coaster of emotions. He was given the hope that new DNA testing might be able to prove his innocence, but then told that the DNA evidence had been destroyed.
And at that point, I was like, I just lost all kind of hope because that would have proved my innocence, you know, without it. I didn't want to go out of town in that fitness system, counsel, mistake. I wanted to prove my innocence because I hadn't committed any crime.
This section was also a little hard for me to understand. But basically, Clarence said that he didn't want to appeal because of ineffective assistance or mistaken identity. He just wanted the evidence to prove that he was innocent.
So I kind of like gave up, and at that point I was lost, and I was just in prison, you know, I just become institutionalized, I guess, at that point. Then several years later, that's when I met this one of them, while I was playing poker in prison, a friend on the phone me asked me to come holler at his mother because there was I got on the phone and I spoke to the lady just teasing with her thing. And we always held the conversation and thing, and lady asked Christy right until I told her, I don't mess with no so called free world people because I had stopped a lot. I wouldn't even have any communication with my family or anyone from the outside. Because I basically had resigned to that. That's why I'm going to live and die in prison, and that I didn't want to have anything to do with the so-called free world. That's what I call the so-called free world.
Clarence had resigned himself to living in prison and given up contact with anyone in the free world until one day another inmate asked him to talk with a woman he had never met before.
Well, this young lady started writing me and witnessing to me. Then she started visiting and witnessing to me. And one day she told me, she said, there's a new thing in Atlanta called the George Young Project that they help answer people what you write them. I said, no, it ain't the Jordan Project. That's the New York Emerson Project. She said, no, it's the Jordan. It's a new one. They like that. I said, no, I wrote the New York Project about 4 or 5 years ago. And they ain't wrote me back yet. She said, well, you need to write them. You know, I said, well, I write them, you know, since you asked me. And I wrote the Jordan Project.
This young lady's name is Yvonne, and she's largely responsible for the Georgia Innocence Project taking Clarence's case.
And a couple of weeks later, I got a letter back from them and told me they would review my files and stuff. Then a couple more months later, they told me, well, they were considering taking my case. Then they told me they would take my case. Then next thing I know, they told me they had found the evidence. When they told me that, I kind of like got scared. Whoa, don't let nothing happen to the evidence. You got to hide or put it up somewhere. Don't let nobody have it. Then I said, don't let the state clientele have, because they're the ones who told the story in the court, and they're the ones going to try to tamper with it. They already denied their coat, you know, so I didn't want them to mess with it. She said, they're not going to mess with it. Ain't nothing going to happen to us. Well, don't let nothing happen to it, you know, like that right there. And I said, well, what about that DNA stuff? They do that no more? She said, that's what they do now. She said, that's what we want to do. We want to have DNA tested, Donna. I said, okay, then. They let do DNA test. If you get the DNA test done, it'll prove. She said, well, we got to get it done.
The Georgia Innocence Project was able to locate some DNA evidence that had been previously reported as destroyed. They had the testing done immediately.
Then they got tested, and them came down to visit. She said, we got a DNA test done. Yeah, she said, you want to know what the DNA test show? Well, it said that it was 100% sure that you could not have been the person who committed a crime. She said, did you hear me? I said, yeah, I heard. She said, you ain't silent now. I said, well, that wasn't for me. I said, that test was for you. I said, you know, I already knew I ain't committed a crime. I just want somebody to know that I didn't commit. I said, that test was for you.
Of course, Clarence already knew the results because he hadn't committed the crime. I asked how he was feeling after the results were shared.
Well, when they told me they had them sent it to the lab, they had it tested on, I was happy, you know. I was happy that now that people know that I didn't do it. Then I wasn't thinking about me being released. All I know that now everybody know I ain't committed a crime. I said, well, now they got to go wait all these years. They'll probably have to go do motions and stuff. A retrial probably take a couple of years. I kept, you know, thinking like that.
Clarence was, of course, glad that it had been proven that he had not committed the crime he was accused of. But after having spent so much time in the criminal justice system, he was prepared for a long wait for justice to prevail. More about that process after these words from The Great Courses. I believe that we continue to learn throughout our entire lives, not just when we're in school. And The Great Courses Plus has really helped me with that. With their engaging video lecture series presented by award-winning professors, we have unlimited access to so many lectures on a variety of topics like American history, civil rights, cooking, or even photography. And they're available anytime on any device. I just discovered this great series called Forensic History: Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. And I want you to sign up so you can watch this series as well. It's so interesting. There are insights into what happens when forensics are used incorrectly and how that can lead to wrongful convictions. It has helped me to understand how forensics has played a role in the incarcerations of the many guests on my show. Trust me, this is a must watch. And right now, you can watch it for free. All you have to do is sign up for The Great Courses Plus as one of my listeners, and you'll get a free month of unlimited access. So, to start your free month trial today, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual.
Yeah, about a week later, you know, Amy told me that they called me down to the intake, told me I had to go to court. I said, what am I going to court for? I said, I ain't got no DR. And I said, I don't serve my DR around like that. So he said, no, he said, you're going to free world court. I said, free world court? What I got to go to free world court for? I don't know. You need to get all your stuff that bring it on down here so we're going to court this morning.
Clarence was told that he was going to court on the day of. I noticed that he mentioned DR court, and I told him I wasn't familiar with that term.
That's disciplinary court in prison when you get getting written up for something like fighting or anything like that.
So, Clarence, without knowing why, was headed to free world court.
I got the courtroom. They had these in free world clothes, and well, they had regular clothes. I call them free world clothes for my, you know, different from my prisons, right? And I was told I need to put these on. I said, them free world clothes. He said, yeah, you got to put them on to go in the courtroom. I said, yeah. When they started doing it, I said, what I'm up here for? He said, you don't know. I said, no, I don't know what I'm up here for. He said, well, you need to hurry up and put the clothes on so you know when you go in now. So I put the clothes on. I said, what I look like, man? What is this and what I had on? Just the style in. He said, yeah, just the style. I said, oh, okay. He said, that's what I look. You know, you tight. You know, I said, okay. So when I go out there, I see all them folks out there, and then I see some of my family members. So I said, what's going on? Then they pulled me over to the table with Mr. David Wolf. I had seen him on TVs and stuff. While we're impressed, I seen him on TV a lot, representing guys. And they...
I just wanted to point out that Clarence has been taken out of prison, dressed in civilian clothes, and brought to a courtroom where his family and attorneys were all waiting for him. But the thing was, Clarence didn't know why this was happening.
Told me to go over there and tell you where he was. Then I look, I said, hey, Mr. David Wolf, he's supposed to be the best lawyer in charge. You know, I'm looking at. So, but I'm thinking this is somebody else that they were talking about. So I really don't hear what they're talking about. I'm still so fascinated about being out here with this free world clothes on. And then I'm seeing my family. I'm trying to see what my family member doing in here and stuff. And I'm really not understanding what was going on. And George said, well, you're free to go, Mr. Harrison.
The judge says, you're free to go, Mr. Harrison.
And I was just sitting there, and he touched me on the shoulder. He said, did you hear the judge? I said, what'd she say? She said, you're free to go. And I said, to go. I said, oh, I got to go back to the cell. He said, no, you're being released. I said, what you mean I'm being released? The judge said, you're free to go. You can go home now. So I can go home. So to me, I'm saying something don't happen. I don't even know where it is. And I said, this got to be a mistake. Cause, you know, I was about to be, I thought they were going to take cookies. You know, we just done that. So I can go home. He said, yeah.
I cannot imagine how confusing and overwhelming this experience must have been. I asked him if he could describe what happens next.
I looked at the outside and I saw all these people, and I seen all these cameras. Somebody was walking out the door. When the door opened, I seen the lights on the freeway, and I got scared. Because I didn't know what was sick, and that was so scary for me, you know. And they kept trying to push me to go forward, but, you know, and I'm kind of like scared to go out there because I don't know what they expect, you know. And then I'm seeing family members that I didn't even know hollering them And I'm trying to figure out who that is and who, you know, because all my little nephews and things were babies. Now they grown, you know. So I didn't know them, you know. And that was kind of, I was looking at that. And when I got outside and I'm saying, well, go home. I said, I don't even know where my home at. You know, I don't even have a home anymore. You know, so I didn't know where I was going to be going, stay, anything.
He didn't know where home was. Can you imagine not knowing where you're going to be living on the day you gain your freedom?
the new people asked me what I wanted to eat, and I just told them, so I wanted some fried chicken, collard greens, cornbread. You know, I want some real food like that. Then they asked me what I wanted as well. I said, if possible, I like to try to. I got first, I try to find me a job, and hopefully, I can make enough money where I can buy this young lady who helped me come get out of here a ring, and hopefully, one day she'll marry me. You know, like that.
I love a love story, and we'll talk a bit more about this later. So, where did Clarence go when he was released, and what did he do with himself?
I went to her home. I lived at her house, and she went and stayed with her daughter and let me live in her house. When I first came home, all I wanted to do was, and what I was doing was, you know, I wanted to spread the word, try to help other people, try to help save many young people from going to prison. I started doing a little program called Handling It Before Prison, trying to stop the young people from going into prison, stop it before they even enter prison. I started going to schools and trying to talk to kids and doing speaking engagement with lawyers, telling them about how I thought the wrong conviction occurred and stuff. Then we got a music program called Life 2020, telling my story. And we started doing that, trying to promote the Elson Project and raise funds for them and things. I just tell the story. They play the music. And the music is based on my story, and it tells the whole thing about my story. From my words, my experience, and that what the music, the songs are based on.
Working with the Innocence Project, Clarence helped to create an album called Life 2020. Here's a little more information about that.
I am extremely proud to be hosting this event tonight on behalf of the Georgia Innocence Project.
Do not assume you know who's guilty.
Musicians Melanie Hammett and Ben Holtz initially wanted to write a song to educate people about those wrongfully convicted in the U.S. But Amy Maxwell got Clarence involved, and through this collaboration, this struggle became alive in songs.
No future, no past.
The three of us sat down in the Georgia Innocence Project office, and what was going to be a song turned into 12 songs at this point because Clarence's story is so rich.
My mama's face.
All the song was based on my life experience, but all of them is speaking for all the people wrongly accused.
It's an opportunity for his voice to be heard.
It just didn't happen to me or happen to the one that in there. It could happen to anyone.
Make it, zoom, zoom, wham, wham.
So I asked Clarence what his advice would be to someone who found themselves in a position of wrongful conviction.
My advice is try to stay strong and keep faith, you know, and never give up. And you fight, always fight, never give up.
Then I asked what he thought the public could do to help.
Really, if they can hold a court, see, a lot of the things, you know, they holding the wrong people responsible. The main people that are responsible is the system, and the system is the courts and stuff. A lot of things wouldn't even happen if lawyers and judges and stuff do their job. And basically, like my case, for instance, had the district attorney done their job and then police investigator done their job, I would have never even been arrested, even went to no trial. They couldn't even approach me with that. Because when I asked them, my main question was, how y'all implicated me in crime? They keep saying the victim possibly identified my photograph. Why was my photograph in the lineup in the first place? How was I implicated prior to that? But they couldn't answer that question. It all started at the very beginning of the trial. In every case, mistaken identification would occur if the proper procedure is done at the prior earlier part of the investigation. Because the district attorney have a job to exclude every possibility of a person being innocent before they even charge. If they do their job, it wouldn't happen.
I wanted to know a little bit more about the story of Clarence and his wife.
Yeah, I always like to thank my wife because she's been a blessing and an angel in my life. And we got married 18 days after our release. Yeah, so September 18th is our anniversary. She the one who introduced me to the project, and she the one who also helped raise the money to pay for my DNA tester. And the bigger part about it, when I met her and stuff, she never had me. Then one day she asked me what I was locked up for. And I said, you don't know what I'm locked up for? She said, no. She said, you've been coming to see me all the time and visiting and writing me and stuff. You know what I'm locked up for? I said, well, I tell you what I do. I said, but I tell you, you ain't gonna believe me. If I tell you I didn't do it, you ain't gonna believe me. I tell you what I do. I just send you my transcript. Then I sent him a transcript. So she said, I thought it don't tell me what you locked up for. I said, that's who they talking about me. She said, but it don't say you did. And I said, yeah, they saying that was me who supposed to commit the crime. You know, I said, that's what I keep saying myself, you know. She said, you should have had you a lawyer. I said, yeah, I know that. I said, if I'd have had a real lawyer, I wouldn't be in here today. She said, I'm going to get you a lawyer. How you going to get me a lawyer? Lad? I said, you can't even pay your own bill. I said, that's why you working two jobs now trying to keep your bills up. She said, no, I don't get another job. I said, so you're a superwoman. You get three jobs to help me. She said, yeah. And true enough, she did. She got a third job washing dishes and got a lawyer for me. And that lawyer, and she asked me what I wanted the lawyer to do. I told her, I want you to gather that lawyer to see could he find the DNA evidence. And then, and that's what she paid him for. And he told me that the evidence wasn't destroyed. He said, the evidence exists. He just had to locate. He said, no, the evidence ain't been destroyed. But he just got to find out where the evidence is located. And that's the first time I started believing, you know, that I can get out of here. Other than that, I had accepted my fate. I want to live and die in prison. Yeah, but she was really just there to witness me and would come to visit me and witness and send me scriptures and stuff. And over the years, you know, and we never even talked on for a relationship style like that. She was always there to witness and trying to, you know, get me to change my life and all that. Until when I got out and stuff, that's when I said that to her, you know, and it kind of she looking at me crazy. Now look at her crazy. We never talked about stuff like that.
I asked him the name of this amazing woman who had stood beside him through his struggle.
Yvonne Harrison.
Clarence had a lot of people he was thankful for.
I also like to thank the George Johnson Project because they was the valid part in my being releasing things. That's why I always tried to board all my time and stuff and trying to help them raise funds, keep them doors up because without them, nobody can come out. We needed the George Johnson Project to bring the people out of prison to jail. But right now, I like to thank David Wolf, who was the trial attorney. I never got the chance to thank him, you know. And the district attorney, Jeff Brickman, he pushed her, hurry up and get me out. He wasn't the district attorney who convicted me. He was the district attorney in the office at the time, you know, that I did, you know, release. And he's been a very good person since I met him and things. And even now, we still talk on the phone from time to time or go out to lunches. And he became a good friend. David Wolf always, yeah, and David Wolf, we go out. And a lot of these people that was there to help me have maintained, continue to be friends and stuff, and always there have been there to support me with things I needed in the bond.
To be completely honest, I expected to end the interview at this point. Man gets his freedom and gets the girl, and on the side records a CD. However, this happy ending didn't turn out to be as happy as we might have hoped. I make it a point not to ask exonerees about their settlements, because frankly, it's none of my business. I'm under the impression that time is worth more than money, and you can never give someone back their time. But in this case, Clarence brought up the subject.
Right now, I'm kind of, in the state now. Well, I feel like I'm being prosecuted all over again because of, you know, when you go through, when you get out and things, you conversate and things, then I went through so much with my conversation. I feel like that. There have been injustice, you know, with that. Justice never been served. Nobody ever been accountable. You know what I'm saying? I haven't been, you know, my life ain't been, you know, my life probably worse off now than it was before I even, you know, got out, you know. And I hope that because of, you know, they award me compensation, then they come back and tax me, which caused me to try to sell the annuity.
What he is referring to is his bankruptcy in March of 2015. Clarence was awarded a $1 million sum payable as an annuity over 20 years. He, needing the money, sold the future annuity to Seneca One, a business that buys them and delves out lump sums in cash for less than the actual value. However, not realizing how large the taxes would be, he suffered a loss on this transaction.
Yeah, they taxed it. See, there was no safeguard to protect me in any way with the compensation that they awarded because they taxed it. Then when I got hit by a car, you know, I don't have medical insurance. Why wouldn't we have medical insurance? I can't get disability because we don't have anything put in Social Security. So there never been any safeguard for me to rebuild my life. You know, everything that they say they gave me, they took back from me. You know, they are responsible because they never put any safeguard for me. When they awarded mine, they gave it to me from a year-to-year basis. I hadn't been in contact with money in over 18 years. What I know about money, how to manage money things from 1 year to the next. But see, I was a guinea pig because the next salary come out, they was able to do it from month to month. And knowing how everything that would happen to me, they corrected for the next one. But still, Rachel asked me to make it come back and correct my error, what y'all allowed to happen to me. They continued to leave me empty-handed.
It doesn't feel like the attempt to compensate Clarence filled his needs. There are no words that I can say to help make sense of the mess that became Clarence's compensation. But despite all this hardship, Clarence still wants to help others.
I really want to try to help others that I read by trying to get some type of law passed, compensation law. So what happened to me won't happen to other Zaris in the future, because they don't have any understanding of what is the compensation law. Valve, we don't have no law down here. Then there'd be a war of money, having no knowledge how this money work and how to manage, and no safeguard. They got to have some safeguard to protect them, you know, to have a future. If they don't, they're going to be like me. If it wasn't for my wife, then I'd probably be on the street homeless. She's the only income in my household. I don't have no income whatsoever. I'm living off my wife. I didn't come out of prison to do that, live off my wife. No, that ain't what I want to do. I'd rather stay in the prison and come out here to be a burden to someone else. So I come out, I was happy, and then have no anger or anything. But over the years, since, you know, feeling this injustice from this conversation and all this and legislation and stuff, you know, it brings up anger that I hadn't felt in years, you know. Once I was fighting for my freedom, now I got to fight for justice. When do it stop?
I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. The Actual Innocence website is www.actualinpod.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at actualinpod or email actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. If you would like to donate to the show, you can do so on the website or at www.patreon.com/actualinpod. Your donations and support of the sponsors help to make this podcast sustainable and ensure that Actual Innocence will be able to continue production in the future. Due to listener requests, there's now a Facebook group where people can discuss the different stories featured on the show. Just search for Actual Innocence and you'll find it. Thanks again for listening.